Greetings, everyone. This is Minko Yakubar with Urban Star Media. I'm here with one of the original Black Panthers. It's a pleasure, Brother Kato.
How you doing?
How you doing, brother?
You were out of the Los Angeles chapter?
Right, Southern California chapter.
Okay, okay. And the year that you joined?
1969.
69?
Yes.
Could you share with us a little bit of what kind of interests you and drove you to become one of the Black Panthers?
Well, I'd always been involved in community service, but I was doing it mostly for the mayor's office. The mayor at the time was a guy named Sam Yorty, but his field deputy was a Black woman named Ethel Bryant. Mm-hmm. So I worked with her on developing youth advisory councils in South Central L.A., under the assumption that we would be heard, and that didn't happen. When the L.A. Police Department attacked the Southern California headquarters on Central Avenue, I was working at KHJ TV radio in the news department, mm-hmm. and I remember reading the news dispatches, mm-hmm. and none of what was on the news wires reflected what I knew was going on in the community.
Right.
I decided I needed to be a part of the response to that. And I felt way too comfortable working at a TV station in Hollywood, and all of this was going on in my neighborhood. So I went down to the local chapter and joined.
Yeah, as a person from Southern California, LA County to be exact, It just fascinates me to get kind of like a real account of, you know, urban history. A lot of times when you hit the history books, the actual true accounts don't come in. As a person that was born and raised in L.A. County, I'm familiar with some of the things that went on, you know, with my parents and so forth. And I heard of a white group called the Spook Hunters, and it was explained to me that the reason why the Slaussons, Gladiators, and businessmen originally organized was because they were getting attacked from outside sources.
That is very likely. They would have congregated anyway just because of social pressures.
Yeah.
But the thing that made them more defensive was the fact that there were white kids who could come in to the community without any opposition from the local police, slip in, do what they wanted to do, and slip out. So I would not doubt that at all.
Well, I mean, are you familiar with any sort of things that they used to do when they come into the community?
They would come in and jump out of the car, jump on a couple of cats on the corner, or shoot at them, and then take off. That's what I remember. I grew up initially in Watts on 120th and Wadsworth, okay. and they typically wouldn't come that far in. Mm-hmm. But when I moved to 69th and Main Street, which was a lot closer to Central L.A., mm-hmm. That was easier for them to get in, do what they needed to do, and the freeway was two right blocks there. Away.
Yeah.
They could just jump on the freeway and be gone. If they went into Watts, there was no freeway. So they had to go through us to get out of there, and so they didn't even bother with it.
And then Watts is kind of funny. You get trapped up in there if you don't know how to get around.
Yeah, yeah.
Narrow streets. And there's a particular historical event that is kind of, you know, when people talk about it, they talk about the US organization and the Black Panthers. And as how they became rivals with the FBI sending each organization written material of the other, making it seem like, can you expound on that?
They played us. you know, we were very naive. We were innocent. We thought we would be under their radar. And it was brilliant. All they would do is they'd write a poison pen letter to Ron Karenga, over at the ESSA organization and say it was from the Black Panthers, and then they would do the same thing to us. Mm-hmm. And we didn't bother to sit down and try and have a conversation with each other about it.
Right.
We just took it to be authentic and reacted to it. And that's a lesson learned.
Right. So your experience in communication, working with the television station, did you bring that to the Black Panthers? What was your expertise?
No, I went there thinking they wanted me to train people in martial arts or hand-to-hand combat, that sort of thing. Because that was the expertise I knew I had. And that was the only impression I had of the party. When I got there, they weren't interested at all in going into the sewers and staking out police. They weren't interested in that. Everything I thought I knew about them was wrong. When I went in, what they wanted was for me to help serve the free breakfast program to the children.
Right.
And that was my first job, serving breakfast in the mornings. And then in the afternoons, we'd go out and sell the newspaper. And in the evening, we'd have political education classes. Mm-hmm. Never discussion about a gun or killing cops or offing the pigs or any of that. That, I determined later, was just rhetoric for the media because it would get attention.
Right.
But it was not what the party was about. We were developing programs. And that was where I was most useful.
So can you expound on some of the programs? Because a lot of misnomers as to what...
We had a free breakfast for school children program long before it was commonplace. Right. Now you have them in most school districts.
Right.
But that's because they co-opted it.
Yes.
It was good. It was effective. It served a purpose. And so the government said, yeah, we're going to do that. But we had a free ambulance program. We had a we bought a manufacturing outfit in the South.
Right.
That and we made shoes, so we gave away shoes in the community.
I never knew that.
We had a free shoe program. We had liberation schools. Every chapter had a liberation school.
What was the extent of a liberation?
Well, the children would come. There were two ways it worked. One is they would come in the after school, they'd get help with their homework. They'd come on Saturdays and they'd get an expansion to their education. All the stuff that was missing from their history books, we would cover in the Saturday liberation schools. And during the summer, we had it all summer long, where we broadened their understanding of the world they live in and their place in it. We had, I think I mentioned the free ambulance program, free medical clinics. Mm-hmm. We had a free lab technician course.
Wow.
In Los Angeles, where we trained people to be lab technicians. Mm-hmm. So they could work in our medical clinics. So those are the kinds of programs we had.
It sounds like the Black Panthers was really the precursor to a lot of social programs that was implemented by the government.
What we did, we had a 10-point platform and program. Mm. We looked at what the needs were in the community. We tried to develop programs to address that need. And the reason behind it was a concept called heightening the contradiction. And that means you go in and you show everyone what's missing. Mm-hmm. And you do that by providing it.
Right.
Not by just giving lip service about this is what we need. We would go in and we create programs to meet that need.
Right.
That heightens the contradiction because then people, the community, can see we've been paying all these taxes and none of this stuff has been happening. We haven't been getting any of this. In the Los Angeles chapter, we eventually developed what's called a physical culture program. We taught martial arts, self-defense, physical fitness for people who just wanted to get in shape.
Yes.
I taught those. We had a consumer program where we'd find get people who were being exploited by real estate companies and retailers, and we would help them work their way through the complaint process so they could get effective redress. Those are the kinds of programs we had in the Black Panther Party.
So, I mean, it sounded like it was a bunch of educated people in the Black Panthers. I mean,
well, it depends on how you define education.
Yes.
In the beginning, a lot of the people in the party were coming out of the colleges, community colleges. Mm. A lot of them were people coming out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC.
Right.
But as the party developed, what we looked for was what we called lumpin' proletariat, street people, because they're really bright too.
Right.
They're really well educated.
What was the term you used?
Lumpin' proletariat.
I gotta look that up.
The underemployed, unemployable, those were the lumpin' proletariat.
Okay.
And we started focusing on them in about 69. That's what, in fact, when the party went underground in about 1970, one of the coordinators in the, I went in the underground cadre, one of my coordinators was an ex-pimp out of San Diego named Jimmy Johnson. Brilliant brother. Brilliant. He didn't have that college education, but he was brilliant.
At the street, smarts.
Yeah, so when you talk about educated, we need to define what that means.
Right.
And I have a lot of college, so I know words this long.
Right.
But I have a brother, a younger brother, Larry Cooks. In fact, he lives in Las Vegas, who was always brighter than I was. He didn't have the formal education.
Right.
But he could walk up to a building, look at it, and tell you how many square feet of tile you would need to roof it.
Yeah.
But he didn't have that formal education.
Right.
So what I do, and I learned this in the party, you define the terms.
Right.
Before you begin the conversation, define the terms so that you know you're talking about the same thing.
Right.
So I can say educated because all those brothers were educated, everyone who came through there. And sometimes the cats with the formal education knew less, lots less, than the brothers who came off the block.
Right.
You know, because we were the ones who came off the block. We were right in the belly of the beast, and we were never comfortable.
So you joined the Panthers at what age?
I was 18.
And you were working at the TV studio at 18?
Yeah. Well, I graduated from high school when I was 16.
Okay.
So yeah, I advanced when I was in grade school, and they pushed me up a couple of grades.
Because if you were teaching martial arts, and that was... So you started martial arts at a young age?
Oh, my dad started us. I was 5, 6 years old.
Okay. Was your dad, and putting you in martial arts and this and that, was it something that he felt that you should have because of what was going on in society, or is it just something that was in him?
Well, both. He grew up in Mississippi and Louisiana. And he knew he had to be able to take care of yourself.
Right.
He went to the Marine Corps, was a drill instructor there in hand-to-hand combat. So all of his children could do a couple of things, period. We could all cook, because he felt if you couldn't feed yourself, take care of your house, you were not really a man. You had to be able to do everything in the house. You didn't depend on someone else to do it. And you had to be able to take care of your family. And that meant not only going out and being able to earn a living or make a living, but it meant sometimes keeping people off your porch. And that had to get physical sometimes. So we had guns all over the house. I grew up around guns, and I grew up knowing how to throw hands.
Well, that's a good combination. You mentioned something about the street sewers. And just, I had an opportunity to deal with some cats that were from the US organization, and they were telling me that it was a part of their program to chart the sewers in case it was civil unrest or something of that sort.
Actually, all of the revolutionary groups back then were involved in that kind of activity.
Okay.
And we were all doing it. There was a book called The Anarchist Cookbook.
I heard of that book before.
And we all read it. Us read it. The Red Guard read it. The party, we all read it.
the Red Guard?
That was a group that developed around Fremont High School, okay. And it was a Maoist group, purely Maoist, but it was all black folks in it, mm-hmm. And it was just another revolutionary group.
You know, the authorities always, the news media always have a way to try to label people, and you know, a lot of organizations back then and people, they were calling either communists, Marx, due to, I guess, reading certain materials. Mm-hmm. And I believe I've heard them classify the Black Panthers in such fashions.
They did. I answer that question this way. Karl Marx said, "I'm not a Marxist." So we read a lot of stuff.
Right.
We took everything in that we could use. And the stuff that was useful, we kept. And the stuff that wasn't, we just disregarded it. So we read Karl Marx. We read Frederick Engels. We read Mao Zedong. But we also read James Baldwin and Franz Fanon. It didn't make us them.
Right.
In fact, what the Black Panther Party developed was a concept called revolutionary intercommunalism. And that was penned by Huey P. Newton. And that had elements of a lot of things, but it was specific to our conditions, black people, here. Not the Industrial Revolution, not anything that went on in Europe in 1916, but what we're dealing with here, well, then.
It seemed like a lot of the materials that the Black Panthers developed, we need right now.
There are lessons to be learned. What the party did, we can't take it just as it was and apply it to present conditions.
Right.
That would, I believe that would require a current analysis.
Right.
Based on what exists now in terms of both resources and threats. But there are a lot of tools that we developed then that we could just slide right over.
Right.
And would fall right into place. Liberation schools, they've been doing that since the 30s. So it wasn't new. We're not doing it now as in the way that we should be doing it. We
so
should.
You say in the 30s, so the history of that, who was the original?
Well, if you can go back to slavery, mm-hmm. that period, they wouldn't let us in their schools. They wouldn't let us go to their churches. Mm-hmm. So we built our own church and made the church a school. That became our liberation school, because there we learned all the stuff they would not have taught us in their schools anyway.
It's amazing how the church has changed.
It is, yeah.
It was the beacon of liberation.
Back then.
Yeah, back then. Now, I don't know what it is.
Well, you know, I'm kind of like this with the church. Richard Pryor said this on stage once. He says, "I support black people doing anything positive." So when I look at some churches, some mosques that are bringing us up, I support that. And I can support that without supporting the church itself.
Right.
Or the other church teachings.
Right.
But when the black Muslims, Nation of Islam, went to the streets and got brothers off the streets, got them cleaned up, got them to reading, writing, dressing well. I support all of that.
Yes.
Because that made them into real men.
Right.
Like Malcolm. But I don't have to become a Muslim.
Right.
To support that.
Right.
I don't have to become a Christian to support a Christian movement that does positive things for us.
Right. And that's one of the things that I think that we need to learn how to differentiate from. You know what I mean? Because it's like if your brother, if it's a group over there that is enhancing the community at large, they should be supported, regardless of...
Well, that activity should be supported.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that sometimes that can be challenging, because a lot of churches can be very exploitative. Cat says, "God told me I need a $17 million jet." That's a stretch for me. That's not serving the people.
Right.
And I always hear this saying, what would Jesus do? Jesus wouldn't do that.
So when the more charismatic leaders in the Black Panthers, when they started getting knocked off by the system, if you want to terminalize mm-hmm. it like that, what kind of atmosphere did that create in the streets?
Well, define the street, because if you're just talking about
our
community,
I'm talking about our community.
They thought we were doomed. They said, oh, they're in trouble now. Within the party, we had a saying. Fred Hampton said this famously. You can kill a revolutionary. You can't kill the revolution. We're still here. I'm still here. They killed a lot of us, but we're still here. What we did not do was buy in to a personality cult. We bought into a movement. And the movement goes even as personalities drop off. One of the things that happened that I think really illustrates that was the division between Huey P. Newton's party and the party that Eldridge Cleaver wanted to see. Mm-hmm. You had personalities, powerful personalities.
Yes.
And folks followed the people who spoke to them.
Right.
Huey Newton's vision spoke to me. Protracted warfare. Service to the people. First, service. Eldridge Cleaver's approach was, let's get all these guns that we can and let's go to war with the police. That doesn't serve the people. In fact, strategically what happens, whenever there's an assault on a cop anywhere, and I'm thinking specifically recently of the one in L.A. where this person ambush those two cops.
You're talking about Compton?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What happens when that happens is the police, they attack the entire neighborhood.
Yes.
They're not just looking for that individual. We all fit the description. So they attack all of us. So what we in the party had to do was consider that in everything that we did. That anything we did that was oppositional to the police, the entire community would end up having to answer for that.
Right.
So we moved our operations into the communities. We got rid of the big buildings we had, and we got houses. And we operated from those houses in the neighborhoods amongst the people.
So 1968, 1970 was a major transition in L.A. County as far as the community is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
69, when you talk about Crips and Blood start coming on the scene. What do you feel that kind of contributed to the transformation of how these people thought and changed in the community? Because from the Black Panthers to Crips and Bloods, that's a big contrast. And then when you look at the Slawsons, Gladiators, and Businessmen, I used to hear stories. I never heard stories that, you had fist fights. You might have had a person that would bring out a chain or a bumper jack, but guns wasn't really involved. Could you speak to that transformation?
Yeah, first of all, it's kind of a false equivalency when we're talking the Black Panther Party and any of the gangs.
Yes.
They were on parallel paths. We didn't conflict with each other. We sometimes occupied the same space, but there was never a conflict. Evolution.
Okay, so like if you shared the same space, what was the relationship?
I have a bunch of nephews right now who are Bloods and Crips. So we knew each other. We respected each other, and we knew where not to get off. I never went into their spaces trying to tell them what they should be doing. They're grown men. If they ask, I'll share what I know. If I see them doing something suicidal or something that would significantly impact the community, I would share that with them. But I never tried to boss them around. I never tried to dominate them.
Right.
All right, because that's challenging their manhood.
Right.
That pushes them into a corner. And they never came to me trying to get me to support anything they were going to do that might be illegal or might be questionable.
So the leadership situation, it wasn't never no trying to ally with each other to work together for the good of the community?
Not within the gangs. This is kind of what happened with gangs is they evolved. Mm-hmm. The gangs have always been there.
Yes.
Always. Long before there was Slauson Village and the Gladiators and the Businessmen and the Outlaw, before all of that, there were other gangs.
Right.
White gangs, because they owned that space at the time.
Right.
As we created our own gangs within those spaces as our population increased.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened is the people in those gangs got older.
Right.
We either went to prison, we died, or we aged out of it. I'm 70 years old. I was in a gang when I was 14. That stuff got old fast because I had other stuff I wanted to do.
Right.
I was in a gang called Bop Town. We were allied with the Businessmen.
Okay.
But we were in the middle of Slauson Village and Gladiators. We were stuck in that spot. But that got old. We grew out of that.
We get a lot of information where people say different things. What actually started the feud between Huey P. and Bobby Seale?
I wasn't there. I can tell you what I heard from other comrades who were there. Huey had gotten really deep into drugs. And a lot of the money that we normally would use for our programs were being siphoned off. And Bobby objected to that because Bobby was about the program. And to my understanding, that was the cause of their split.
So you were saying that in 1970, that's when the Panthers went underground.
Yes.
In the sense of going underground, I've ran across some Black Panther organizations today, and there's many different Black Panther organizations. I mean, that consider themselves Black Panther organization. Can you speak to that? Because I've seen some...
Anyone can call themselves a Black Panther Party. I think that there was only one Black Panther Party. And it's centered around the 10-point platform and program. The closest thing to that would have been the New Panther Vanguard movement. I think it began in about 1990. Kwaku Duren, who was the coordinator of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party, after we closed the chapter in Los Angeles, he still needed to serve. He still needed to do that thing. So he began the New Panther Vanguard movement.
Okay.
That New Panther Vanguard movement is the only legitimate heir, in my opinion, to the original Black Panther Party. Everything else is just people wearing berets and jackets and calling themselves Black Panther Party. But if they don't have that 10-point platform and program focused on serving the community, they're not the Black Panther Party.
So when would you say the Black Panther Party officially disband from being underground?
From underground? About 70... All right, which question? Came from underground or...
Kind of the organization... I mean, they went underground.
Yes.
Right. But after going underground, was there a disbanding or
no.
Is it... So it's...
No, we went underground. Going underground was part of a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
We closed all of our chapters around the country. We went underground because we closed all the chapters nationwide, brought everyone back to Oakland because we were going to go into electoral politics. Bobby Seale was running for mayor of Oakland. Elaine Brown was running for city council. So the LA chapter, instead of just closing, it went underground because we already had a structure in place that we needed to maintain. So we went underground and did that. All the other chapters closed. Their staff went to Oakland to work on the campaign. At about 74, 75, in 76, we decided to reopen the Los Angeles chapter, and we reopened it in January of 1977.
And you reopened it in 1977, and then?
Then a couple of things happened. In 1982, we found out that the Black Panther Party no longer existed. We found out because I saw a magazine on a newsstand that said the party's over. I picked it up, read it, and it talked about the Black Panther Party closing. So I took it back to the collective, showed it to Kwaku and the other comrades in the collective. Kwaku got on the phone with the people up north, and they said, yeah, we're not functioning anymore. That's how we found out. But apparently they had not been functioning since 1980. Oh. We didn't know it in Los Angeles because we kept on doing the work, selling the newspaper and running our program.
The communication...
It had fallen apart. Kwaku Duren had been trying to reach someone up north, and he couldn't get anyone on the phone. But we had a very dynamic organization in Los Angeles. We had lots of stuff to do, and we were doing it. We weren't worrying about whether Kwaku could catch up with someone in Oakland. So we continued with our programs.
So I got a few more questions, and we'll wrap this up.
Okay.
How do you think the Black Panther Party affected Los Angeles in the good aspects of the programs that it brought to Los Angeles? Did it have a...
It told them what was possible.
Taught them what possible.
It showed the entire city, the country, the world, what was possible when we got together and organized. I mean, we had an amazing Rainbow Coalition. We were connected with the Brown Beret. We were connected with Yellow Peril. We were connected with the Young Lords organization, all moving in the same direction.
Well, it has been a pleasure speaking with you, and we can go on forever. But if you had any words to say to the young brothers growing up today.
Dare to struggle, dare to win.
Dare to struggle.
If you don't dare to struggle, you don't deserve to win.
Very profoundly said.
Got that from Fred Hampton.
Fred Hampton. Well, thank you, brother, again for this interview. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure's mine.
Yes. Well, we're out with Urban Star with another interview.